What's up, Wildside besties and baddies? I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up
and enjoy the ride.
Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
I imagine that you are wondering why this episode is not entitled Interview With. No, I have not magically turned into Dr. K over the last couple of days. In true wild side fashion, of course, we have had some hiccups with the recording. I'm, of course, out of town, having to run to Wally World, grab a mic, find a conference room. But you know what? It's all gravy, baby.
It's all gravy, baby, right? It's just biscuit wheels on the gravy train.
Biscuit wheels on the gravy train.
Yeah. So, you know, let us learn from this, but our software stuff with the interview with Dr. K all of a sudden kind of just disappeared. And so y'all should have seen my absolute panic over the last 2 days.
Did you cry?
So we have been working. I didn't cry. I got into we have to fix this mode. So it was good. But we've been working with the IT department to try to recover this interview. And you guys have to understand, this is Chelsea and my biggest fear when it comes to interviews, because these super smart, important people who are really busy in this world volunteer an hour of their time, and we cannot go back and ask them to do that again. So if we lose an interview, probably most of the time we just lose it. And so fingers crossed that we've got part of the interview, but there's about 40 minutes that for some reason there's a glitch with it not loading. Absolute worst case scenario, we will release what we have. And fingers crossed that IT resolves this problem and we can release the episode fully edited and ready to go on Monday. If not, it might be next Friday.
Yeah.
And we'll just kind of roll with it. But yeah, we didn't want to leave you guys hanging in the wind. We promised you an interview. You won't be getting an interview today, but we're going to just go ahead and give you another case that's still within this silo.
You'll just get more of Chelsea and Bailey.
Yeah.
Yab, jab, dabbing.
Yep, jab, dabbing. And so we scrambled together to get this written up, recorded, edited. Edit's probably not going to be super great because we didn't have a lot of time with it, but we wanted to absolutely deliver on our time frame of Friday. So here we are.
Well, like I told Bailey, knowing our luck, you guys are going to be like, oh my gosh, that was the best episode you've had. You guys should always just scramble and throw one together. This was amazing. That's going to be our luck, where it's like, what?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So this case honestly goes in with Dr. K's interview. I could have used it for Dr. A's interview. We could have used this for a whole bunch of things. So there's a lot going on with this case.
Nice.
Yeah. And so this is the tragedy of the Choi family.
Okay. Where is this located?
So this case, from the beginning, it starts in a suburb outside of Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And the suburb is known as Brockton, okay, Massachusetts. And fun fact, I really wanted to start with this. Sean Fanning, who is the creator of Napster, is from this area.
Raise a hand if you remember illegally downloading music via Napster or LimeWire.
I literally wrote, I know that gave everyone listening flashbacks of pirating music on their family computer.
Yes, we all did.
Yeah,
we all did. And then I remember that I heard a thing that Metallica was going to sue all of us for pirating their music. And I was like, am I going to get sued by Metallica? Is that a thing?
Metallica can sue us, and then we're going to sue you too for downloading all of their music into our phones against our permission.
That's right.
Yeah, so we are back up in the Northeast. This is Brockton, Massachusetts, and it takes place in a nice little suburbia type of community on the street of Bel-Air Street. Okay.
Cool.
And there's this nice little upper middle class house, And in that lived the Choi family. So you had Ann Trin Choi, who was 53 at this time, and I'll get there. Ching Jimmy Choi, 64. Francis Choi, who was 17. And Kenneth Choi, who was 16. Mm-hmm. So Ann and Jimmy were Chinese immigrants from Hong Kong and Vietnam, and they had moved to Boston, outskirts of Boston, many years before. Now, Frances, the 17-year-old, she was the couple's biological daughter, and Kenneth was actually Jimmy's grandson, even though they were only a year apart.
Okay.
Kenneth, the grandson, he had left his home of Hong Kong 3 years earlier to come and live with Mama and Papa Choi after his dad, which is Papa Choi's son. After his dad died. So that's what brought Kenneth from Hong Kong to live with the Choi family.
Okay.
So it was reported that Kenneth likely struggled with the transition from Hong Kong to Brockton and was still grappling with his father's suicide.
Ooh.
The Choi family, by all reports, was a conservative, close-knit family, but not without problems like any family system.
Mm-hmm.
Francis's classmates at Brockton High School said Francis had spoken of problems at home because Papa Jimmy was strict, very strict, but he loved his family. Francis was reported as being an academically gifted young woman. She was described as outgoing, she was an honor roll student, and she worked hard for her grades. Other people described her as being quiet and gentle and a rule follower who had never been in trouble.
Was Jimmy as strict as Skip? Was he threatening to shave her head if she snuck out of the house or got into the devil's lettuce?
I was literally about to say, or smoke the wacky tobacco.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't think so. Didn't think so, Francis. Live in fear of your head being shoved.
Don't call me Francis.
I'm so glad that you thought of that as well.
Yeah. So Francis was a senior at Brockton High School, and she was planning to attend college in the fall after her upcoming graduation from high school in just a few months. However, everything changed in a flash for the Choi family in April of 2003.
Okay.
At 4:50 in the morning on April 17th, 2003, Francis was awoken by her mother's panicked scream, yelling, "Francis, there's a fire.
Lord, there's a fire. Ain't nobody got time for that.
Inside the house, a fire was burning with such intensity that it had melted the wall fixtures, and thick smoke had trapped Francis, Kenneth, and Papa Jimmy and Mama Ann in their bedrooms.
Nope.
911 operators quickly received a call from the Choi residence on Bellevue Street in Brockton. The girl on the other end of the call was Frances Choi, who was calling to report a fire at her family's residence. 911 operators alerted the Brockton Fire Department and quickly made their way to the scene. When firefighters responded to the suburban home, they observed smoke billowing out of the house. They noticed Kenneth Choi looking out of a second floor window and using a ladder. Firefighters climbed up and pulled Kenneth from the house that was quickly being engulfed in flames.
What do you think of when you think of house fires?
What do I think of when I think of house fires?
The roof is on fire. We don't need no water. Let the mother burn.
Never think about that.
Nope. Okay. All right.
Nope. So when they pulled Kenneth down to safety, firefighters then saw Francis's head leaning out of a different second story window. So they climbed up to retrieve Francis, and that's when she told the firefighters that her parents were still in the burning house. Firefighters entered the home to attempt to rescue Papa Jimmy and Mama Ann. One of the firefighters on scene, Brian Nardelli, entered the master bedroom and found Mama Ann lying on her bed. Not wasting any time, he picks her up, carries her outside to safety. He goes back inside to try to find Papa Jimmy. Brian finds Papa Jimmy lying on the floor between the bed and the window. Brian picks up Papa Jimmy, carries him out of the house and to where the paramedics were waiting. Immediately, paramedics began providing medical interventions and treatments to Mama Ann and Papa Jimmy.
Okay.
Mama Ann was rushed to the Good Samaritan Hospital in Brockton, where she unfortunately died upon arrival. Papa Jimmy was airlifted to a hospital in Boston where he was in critical condition.
Like, she died from smoke inhalation?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So while the Choi family was in the hospital, police began questioning Kenneth along with Francis. And Francis was in the hospital being hooked up to an oxygen tank, right? She's hooked to oxygen because they're both having issues from being in the house during the fire.
Right.
Police officers took their clothing for evidence, brought the clothing back to the fire scene, and then they ended up bagging it. After stabilizing, Francis and Kenneth were released from the hospital. When they were released, they went back to the home to meet some of their relatives outside of the house, which I think is a pretty normal thing, right? Your house burns down.
Yeah.
Your family meets you there to try to see what's going on, you know, try to get any information.
Yeah.
So when they were there talking with their family members, officers arrived and began questioning Francis and Kenneth about the fire. Right around this time, Papa Jimmy was transferred to a different hospital in Boston. And so Francis wanted to leave the scene so she could go to the hospital and be with Papa Jimmy. What's the face?
I don't know. I'm just a little nervous about Francis seeing Jimmy in the hospital.
Yeah.
I have a bad feeling about this.
Officers encouraged Francis to let them take her to the hospital so they could continue their questioning. So during the 30 to 40 minute drive from the house to the hospital, Francis was questioned by State Trooper Warmington in, what fucking town is this? Brockton? And Brockton Police Department Detective Eric Clark.
Don't edit that out.
Okay. When Francis arrived to the hospital, she stayed with her father until she received the news that there was nothing further to be done. And Francis made the decision to remove him from life support.
That's awful.
So in a matter of hours, Francis lost her mother and father. Kenneth lost his grandmother and grandfather.
After losing his father. Like, that's tragic.
Yeah. Now, during this time, obviously, law enforcement personnel began investigating what is now considered the crime scene, right? Because people died. They need to determine, collect evidence, identify if this was like arson,
right?
You know, if a Christmas tree in April burned down, don't really know.
Yeah.
So around 5:55 p.m. that afternoon, Trooper Warmington called Francis and told her he wanted her to come to the house to view her property because it was being boarded up. So Francis arrived at the house around 7:30 and was met by Trooper Warmington, who said that there were items to be collected from the house and she needed to go to the police station to view them. She complies, naturally. If a cop's like, hey, you need to go to the police station to identify the stuff from your house fire, I'm going to go to the police station and identify that, right?
Sure, yeah.
Upon arriving to the police station, Detective Clark and Trooper Warmington begin to interrogate Francis and Kenneth. So Kenneth had made his way over there as well. And they began questioning both of them for hours. Now, this is like the third time that they've been questioned, right?
Yeah.
And what they began to tell Francis is they bring her into interrogation room and they say, how did gasoline get on your sweatpants? And Francis was like, I have no idea what that is or what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they said that her sweatpants that they took from her for evidence when she went to the hospital, they found traces of gasoline on her sweatpants. So they continued to interrogate her until about 11 p.m. And by this time, the family had been up since about 5. So this is 17 to 18 hours later.
17 to 18 hours later, like consistently? Like they haven't gone home and gone to bed anything?
No, I'm saying like by the time that the interrogation ended at 11 p.m., they had been up since 5 o'clock in the morning. So they're being interrogated after like being up after this traumatic event. Losing both parents for 17 and 18 hours they've been up, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, they've been up for this long?
Yeah. During the interrogation, investigators confronted Kenneth about some evidence that they had found in the house. Do you want to know what this evidence is, Chelsea?
A fire starter.
Like a fire log?
Yeah, yes.
They had found in his bedroom a piece of paper, which included a plan to buy gasoline, spread gas around the house, light it on fire, instructions written out on how to burn down the house, including which areas to douse with gasoline.
And that was in
Kenneth's room.
That was in Kenneth's room? And it survived that fire?
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate. Sucks to be you, dude.
So when they confronted Kenneth about finding this evidence, he initially said he told them that a black kid at his school had given him the contents of the notes and told him to share it with others in order to avoid bad luck. And the officers were like, no.
I mean, that was back when you were supposed to forward those emails, those prayer emails. Remember that? And if you didn't forward them to like 20 people, then you would be cursed or something like that. So, I mean, it was a little wild back in the early 2000s.
Yeah. And so they kept pushing him because they're all like, dude, that's not how this works. That's not how this works. Mm. And so eventually Kenneth admitted that he did write the notes, but he didn't intend to kill anybody. Investigators keep going, and they share with him that they don't think that Kenneth had the capacity, whether physically, mentally, emotionally, or whatever, to carry this out alone, based off of the evidence that they're finding. So Kenneth drops a bombshell, and he says that the fire was actually Francis's idea and that she told him to write the notes. He told police that they planned to create a trail of gasoline leading up the cellar steps into the living room and up the stairs to the second floor. Kenneth said that on the night of the fire, he woke up to a noise and found Francis in the basement with 1 or 2 gallon water jugs filled with gasoline. He admitted the only involvement he had was pouring gasoline-filled Sprite bottles on top of the basement stairs, but refused to do anything further and went into his room. He said that on the way to his room, he saw Frances in the living room with a jug of gas, that she was dousing the sofa, the stairs, her parents' door, all with gasoline. Moments later, he hears the sound of a fire and flames starting to crackle.
I mean, okay, but that's pretty, I mean, like, that's dumb. Why would you set your own house on fire and be in the house?
I have no idea.
Like, unless it's a suicide mission.
I'm sure if you think you can get out, unless you can get out in time.
Well,
call the
okay.
fire department. I don't know. So when police asked Kenneth, why on earth would Francis want to start a fire? Kenneth told investigators that Francis had told him that she, quote, wanted better parents. Francis was fed up with the strict lifestyle at home. And that's what was the motivation behind her starting a fire in the house.
Again, did he threaten to shave her head? I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah. So police brought Kenneth to the room where Francis was being interrogated, where he confronted her and accused her of starting the fire. She initially vehemently denied any and all involvement, but later finally said, quote, fine, I did it. But then she recanted.
This bro bad. This B-A-D.
Capital B-A-D. During booking, Frances would end up making more admissions, and then she would immediately retract them. So she was confessing left and right, and then recanting it all.
I mean, the kid's in shock, though. Come on.
On top of that, detectives found it suspicious how, according to them, Frances did not appear upset. She displayed no visible signs of injury after the fire. So based on the testimonies given by Kenneth and Francis during their interrogations and their Francis's confessions, both Kenneth and Francis were formally arrested. Francis was charged with 2 counts of murder and 1 count of arson. And Kenneth was charged with 2 counts of murder, but no counts of arson.
Okay.
Are you following so far?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm here. I'm here for it.
While in jail, awaiting trial, Francis's attorney filed a motion to suppress Francis's statement that she made in interrogation, but that was denied.
Okay.
So her lawyer tried to file a motion saying her confession wasn't valid, but that was denied in June of 2005.
How old is Francis at the time?
In 2003, she was 17.
Is she under 18?
Yes.
I was going to say, she's a minor.
Yes. She and Kenneth are both minors.
Okay. I have lots of thoughts on that, but I'll let you continue.
So she's been in jail at 17 for 2 years. Her attorneys filed this motion. The court says nah. And then 3 more years, Francis Choi's trial finally begins.
Wow. 5 years.
So the fire happened in 2003. Her trial starts in 2008.
Wow.
The prosecution claimed that Francis and Kenneth set fire to their home for money because Francis stood to benefit from what?
Life insurance.
From a $100,000 life insurance policy, and that she wanted a way out of the strict lifestyle, as I said before. On top of that, it was revealed that Francis's resentment towards her parents were more deep than initially understood. The prosecution told the court that Francis's father forbade her from seeing her boyfriend, and they were not allowing her to move out of the home when she went to college.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The prosecution argued that Francis Choi confessed to setting the fires. So during Francis's trial, Trooper Warmington testified that Francis showed little emotion on the day of the fire, even after both of her parents had died. According to Maurice Posley's article, Trooper Washington said that he asked Francis to come back to the house to view her property, and when he offered condolences, Francis seemed more concerned about her possessions, asking, "How's my stuff?" Detective Clark testified that he questioned Francis repeatedly about how gas got on her sweatpants, but she could not explain it. After denying any and all involvement in the fire, Clark testified that he told her he was going to take her to booking, but Francis said she didn't want to go and she wanted to keep talking. So this is all what he's sharing as his testimony during her trial.
Okay.
When he had asked her again to explain how accelerant got on her sweatpants, she blurted out, "Fine, I planned it." Then she paused and said, "No, I didn't."
Wow.
Clark testified that Francis told him she set up cups filled with gasoline on the stairs leading from the basement up to the living room and that the cups were milk and soda containers. He first testified she told him she had gotten the gas from a gas container downstairs, but on cross-examination, he admitted that that was not correct. No cups were found on the basement stairs.
Hmm.
Clark further testified that 5 to 10 seconds later, during this interrogation, Francis said she was lying, she was not involved, and then he said that she was pretty much emotionless throughout the process of the interrogation.
Okay.
When the defense asked for the recordings of the interrogation, Clark said there were none, because there were no recording devices in the station.
No, sir. I don't think that's following protocol. I don't know, but that should be against protocol if it's not protocol.
Mm-hmm. And so then they asked for his written notes that he took, and he said that he didn't have them.
No, sir. Again, no, sir. I have to write notes as a dental hygienist.
Like, as an investigator during a homicide investigation or an arson investigation, I think that notes and recording is absolutely mandatory.
I'm pretty sure that's been a standard since like 1737.
Yeah, before recordings even existed, they used them.
Right?
Yeah. So in addition to Trooper Warmington and Detective Clark's testimonies, the prosecution also brought in State Trooper Michael Peters, who was certified as an accelerant detecting canine handler, and that his canine Gala was also certified.
Mm.
So he testified that Gala alerted for the presence of gasoline at the scene of the fire and on the sweatpants that was confiscated from Francis at the hospital.
Okay.
What's even more damning is that John Drugan, who was a Massachusetts State Police crime lab chemist, testified that he had detected gasoline residue on the sweatpants and two melted plastic discs recovered from the home, and that fluid removed from the two Sprite bottles was gas. So that validates Kenneth's testimony, right?
I was going to say, that is lining up.
On the other side, Trooper Jeanne Stewart of the Massachusetts State Police Fire and Explosion Investigations Section testified that the fire was ignited in a mattress in the basement, but she found that there were no accelerants were used. She concluded that there was no gasoline on the couch, as Kenneth had said that Francis had poured, noting that the velvet cushions on the front of the couch and an Afghan that was hanging over the couch was all undamaged. She also testified that there was no fire damage to the wooden stairs leading from the living room to the second floor, indicating that no gasoline was on those stairs either. Trooper Stewart also testified that she observed a rolled towel at the threshold of the door to Kenneth Choi's room that may have been placed there to prevent smoke from entering the room.
Okay. I mean, how do you get reports that are that polar opposite?
So on January 24th, 2008, after 7 days of trial, the court declared a mistrial when the jury was unable to reach a unanimous verdict. Right?
Yes.
So the day after a mistrial was declared in Francis's trial, Kenneth's trial starts. So on January 25th, Kenneth Choi then went to trial on two counts of murder. And after several days of deliberation, the jury acquitted Kenneth Choi based mostly on the forensic evidence and Francis's confessions.
Okay.
This acquittal prompted Francis's lawyers to seek a retrial, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Francis's attorneys argued that the prosecution presented its case on the premise that Francis was guilty as a sole actor and not working conjointly with Kenneth. And so as a result, the jury had not been given any instruction on how to look at the case through joint culpability.
Okay.
Like, that not given sense. The option or directions of how to look at that with the two-player issue, right?
Yeah.
They argue that the prosecution should be precluded from retrying Francis on a joint venture theory, so saying that it was a coupled thing.
Mm-hmm.
And having failed to introduce evidence of joint venture in the first trial. That motion to bar a retrial was denied.
Okay.
And in 2010, the Massachusetts Supreme Court upheld that ruling.
So where is Frances? Like, what is she doing?
She's still in jail.
So a mistrial doesn't... What does a mistrial mean? I mean, I know what a mistrial means, but what does it mean for her?
It means... that trial didn't work out, and now they have to go through the process of doing it again. New jury, new everything.
Gotcha. Okay.
So in 2011, Francis went to trial a second time. So this is take two. At this trial, Kenneth Choi was granted immunity, and he testified against Francis.
Dude, that's cold.
I know. Against his auntie. During his testimony, he shared the same story he told in the interrogation with officers after the fire in 2003.
Okay.
Despite this, on February 11th, 2011, a second mistrial was declared when the jury, on its fifth day of deliberation, said it was unable to reach a unanimous verdict. So this is trial number two for Francis, and there's now two mistrials.
And this is 2011. This is what? Eight years.
She's been in jail.
Oh, gosh.
Mm-hmm. So with this, 2 weeks after this mistrial was announced, Frances was released on bond pending a retrial. She wasn't out long. So just 3 months later, in May of 2011, she underwent a third trial. I've never heard of a third trial, ever.
I haven't either.
On the day of the trial, prosecutors shared that just a few days prior, Kenneth had taken a one-way flight to Hong Kong.
Got a one-way ticket on a westbound train. See how far I can go.
So since there were records of Kenneth's testimony from the second trial, the judge presiding over this third trial and Francis's trial said, "It's all right. We will allow Kenneth's testimony to be read to the jury in the form of a role play with a prosecutor sitting in the witness stand acting as Kenneth."
I don't like that.
I don't either.
I don't now, like it.
The defense brought in an expert, Dr. Richard Offshee, and he is a false confession expert. He testified about false confessions in general, but the court would not allow him to identify for the jury specific interrogation techniques or situational factors present in Francis's case associated with false and coerced confessions.
Why? Why not?
Don't know. Don't know.
Well, that's dumb.
The prosecution made moving arguments that Francis had a motive, which again was freedom and money. On top of that, multiple witnesses testified that Francis remained way too calm throughout the fire and its aftermath. Alongside Francis's confessions during interrogations, the jury was moved. They were moved by all of this stuff. Now, this is where shit gets crazy. During the trials, the court identified that only Kenneth's fingerprints were on the handwritten notes, and Francis's fingerprints were not on the Sprite bottles or any other items submitted for fingerprint testing.
Oh, Kenneth.
But despite this, on May 6th, are you so mad right now?
I'm just one big eye roll. I am the eye roll emoji.
This is not, to be clear, I'm not laughing at this. I'm laughing at Chelsea just being like, what in tarnation is happening?
Right.
So despite this, despite the court being like, yeah, I mean, Kenneth's fingerprints were on the letter, but they were in his room, so we know that. But Francis's fingerprints weren't on anything. Maybe she was just too smart and academically driven to know to not to leave fingerprints. So on May 16th, 2011, the jury convicted Frances Choi of 2 counts of murder and 1 count of arson, and she was sentenced to life in prison without parole.
Oh my gosh. I mean, maybe she did it, right? Maybe her life just sucked so bad that burning everybody down was the only way out.
It's like a Jennifer Pan kind of thing where she killed her family.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, maybe so she just snapped and she was like, I'm tired of this.
Yeah. So fast forward another 4 years. Now we're in 2015. Okay. Francis's attorney, different attorney, John Barter, was working on an appeal and a motion to reduce her sentence since she was a juvenile at the time of the crime. And from my research, the Supreme Court, during this 12 years of incarceration, they had passed that it's, I don't know exactly how to say it, but basically, they can't do what they've been doing with her because she was 17.
Oh, uh-huh.
Basically, right? Now, this motion, I finally had to just literally bullet this stuff out because this would have been a 38-page paper. But this is why, this is all of the bombshells that this motion included. Are you ready for all of this?
I'm ready.
This attorney came in guns blazing.
Coming in hot.
The black is hot. Okay. Number one, prosecutors Bradley and O'Sullivan, who were the prosecutors for Francis's trials, come to find out they had sent numerous emails back and forth between each other that made racially and sexually discriminatory remarks about Francis, members of her family, and Asians in general.
Nope.
The prosecution also identified that there were hundreds of pages of emails and documents that showed these gentlemen corresponding with racist remarks, insinuating that Frances was sleeping with her nephew, that one picture included a small girl in a KKK garb.
No.
So that's the first piece of this that was included in this motion for a new trial. And they're like,
bullet point one.
They're like, y'all are really super biased and racist, and there's no way that that should be allowed. Right?
Right.
Number two, the judge, Linda Giles, in this new trial, this motion said that Bradley, the prosecutor, pretty much lied to the judge because he was trying to convince her to instruct the jury that the jury could convict Francis either as a principal actor or as an abettor, even though Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court had previously ruled that that was not allowed. So there were different judges in the trials. The prosecutor for the third trial tried to convince the judge, it's fine, let it happen, even though literally the Massachusetts Supreme Court was like, you cannot. Okay. Number three, the motion cited a review of the testimony and test results that were said to show that there was gas residue on Francis's sweatpants. Susan Seabod Hetzel, she is an analytic chemist, provided an affidavit saying that a review of the tests, when measured by the applicable and generally accepted objective science standards, does not support a conclusion that the 100% polyester sweatpants contained any gasoline residue. So she's like, no, it doesn't.
There wasn't any gas.
And that's arguably the biggest factor, because along with Francis's confessions, they're like, she had gas on her sweatpants.
Right.
And this chemist is like, no, she didn't.
Hmm.
Number four, the prosecution claimed in the previous trials that no gas was found on Kenneth's clothes, but his clothes had never been tested for it.
Oh.
So they essentially lied to the court. They left out that information. Number five, the Francis's attorneys found a witness that had witnessed Kenneth bragging about being acquitted because he was the one who bought the gasoline, set the fire, and had gas on his clothes.
Mm-hmm.
The witness said that Kenneth resented Papa Jimmy and Mama Ann because his biological mother back in Hong Kong, the Choys, were asking for more money to support Kenneth. Also, the defense identified and discovered that there were subsequent fires in the Choi home after Francis was arrested. The prosecution was aware and did not inform the defense.
I mean, I feel like that's kind of like that needs to be talked about, right?
And they're legally obligated to share all information with each side, from my understanding. Prosecution also failed to disclose that Kenneth had been charged with a drug possession charge with intent to distribute in a school zone, but they didn't report that.
Because that's not relevant.
Well, and that's a motive for Kenneth, because he was going to get in a lot of trouble for that with the Choys.
Mm-hmm.
Number eight, O'Sullivan, one of the prosecuting attorneys, knowingly or recklessly induced false testimony from Detective Clark at Francis's trials, because Clark had said that Francis had told him she filled up cups with gasoline from a gas container downstairs. In the first trial, Clark admitted on cross-examination that his direct testimony that Francis said she got the gas downstairs was not correct.
Mm-hmm.
So the night before his testimony, O'Sullivan sent an email to Clark. So the prosecuting attorney, Sullivan, sent an email to Detective Clark in his personal email account with a script for him to follow, including the testimony that he had already admitted under oath in the first trial.
No.
Okay, so he was coaching him to get it right.
No.
Number nine, post-conviction attorneys also presented an affidavit from a retired Brockton police detective contradicting Detective Clark's testimony that there were no recording devices in the Brockton police station available to detectives in April 2003. There were recording devices, they just were not used.
Mm-hmm.
In March of 2020, we're 17 years in. Francis's lawyers filed a motion seeking her release on bail pending a ruling of the motion for a new trial. Her defense attorneys were saying she had a spotless record. She got her GED. She got a bachelor's of arts degree in sociology. She graduated magna cum laude from Boston University. She completed 1,000 hours of training, passed the Massachusetts cosmetology examination. She spent 5 years training service dogs for America's Vet Dog Program. So they're like, this girl's amazing. She's been doing really well. We need to allow this. And the prosecution allowed it, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In September of that year, the prosecution agreed that the original prosecution O'Sullivan and Bradley had in fact engaged in misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
The new prosecution said that the trial prosecutor Bradley had been terminated in 2013. O'Sullivan left the office prior to 2015. And another appellate
mm-hmm.
prosecutor who was assigned to handle the post-conviction requests, Gail McKenna, she was terminated for withholding information and failing to obey court orders to disclose the information. So all these people in the prosecutor's office are wilding out, and now they're gone. And so the new prosecution team is just like, yeah, we're really, really sorry about all this.
Yeah.
The prosecution also informed Francis's lawyers that it had discovered Detective Clark's file, despite him saying that he had thrown them away.
Oh.
So he lied.
Ooh, you lie like a Persian rug on the floor. There's a song to that. I can't remember it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. In fact, his notes proved that he falsely testified. These notes contain information that was inconsistent with his testimony. Judge Linda Giles, she did grant the motion for a new trial and vacated Francis's convictions based off of all of this, for sure. Judge Giles noted that the prosecution agreed that the conviction should be vacated because justice may not have been done. I mean,
to put it lightly.
Judge Giles, who presided over the third trial, said that if she had been aware of the emails demonstrating the prosecutor's anti-Asian bias during trial, she would have declared a mistrial and removed the prosecutors O'Sullivan and Bradley from the case.
Right.
But mm-hmm. she didn't know.
Right.
The judge also cited the new evidence contradicting the scientific testimony about gasoline residue, along with the testimony that Kenneth had admitted committing the crimes as ground for granting a new trial. Yes.
Yes.
She also said that the whole Kenneth skipping to Hong Kong without proof of the emails as to why causes the court, and she said it in like a really professional way, but she basically was just like, that makes us question you and we think you're big fat liars. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So collectively, the prosecution's misleading statement to the court and in closing argument presented of evidence that appears in retrospect to have been false and inconsistent in this case and points to the fact that justice was not done.
Okay.
So on September 29th of 2020, the Plymouth County District Attorney's Office dismissed
2003 to 2020.
Yep, like 17 years
I'm
later.
I'm just like, oh my gosh. I mean, I know you said 17 years, but like when you put it like that, I'm like 2020, that was 4 years ago. This thing happened. This thing started in 2003. Sorry. It just kind of like, I don't know. That just kind of hit mm-hmm. different.
Yeah. So on September 29th, 2020, the Plymouth County District Attorney's Office dismissed the charges against Frances Choi after she served 17 years in prison for a crime she did not commit.
Man.
At the end of 2022, more than 2 years later, a complaint alleging misconduct by the prosecutors was still pending with the Massachusetts Office of the Bar Council, which investigates lawyer misconduct.
Yeah.
O'Sullivan apparently got another job as a prosecutor in the Bristol County District Attorney's Office. So, in February of 2023, just last year, Francis Choi filed a federal civil rights lawsuit seeking compensation for the wrongful conviction. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
In June of 2023, the Bar Council filed a petition for discipline against Bradley and Sullivan. Good job.
Wow.
This petition accused them of failing to disclose exculpatory evidence, misstating evidence during closing argument, and exchanging, quote, racially offensive, derogatory, and unprofessional emails.
Yeah. Yeah.
In April of 2024, this month of this year, Choi settled her lawsuit for almost $4 million.
Oh, snap. That's crazy.
And I'm just going to leave us with this. I know that kind of ended quickly, but I wanted to leave us with this little data. Since 1989, more than 2,700 people in the country have been exonerated after being wrongfully convicted of felony crimes. an average of nearly 90 a year. Collectively, they served more than 24,600 years in prison.
Oh my goodness.
These are just the cases that we know about, the ones that garnered headlines in TV news coverage of exonerees who, after spending decades behind bars, walked through prison gates and collapsed into the arms of loved ones.
Oh my goodness.
So, because of, now this one, like I said, it could include false confessions. It could, because Dr. A, when you guys listen to Dr. A's interview, you're going to understand like why Frances did what she did. This could include prosecutorial misconduct. I mean, this whole case is wild.
Mm-hmm.
And the craziest thing is, since they acquitted Kenneth, they can't charge him for this again because it's double jeopardy.
Yeah, it's double jeopardy.
So he walks away.
Oh gosh, that's so sticky.
And she served 17 years.
You know, it's so easy. It's very tempting, I guess I should say, to be like, oh, law enforcement, criminal system, justice system, like it's all corrupt and bloody, bloody, blah. And I think a portion of it is, but I really want to remind us to pause and also realize that there are a lot of people who fight to keep it just and good, and like, don't lose faith in it. Like, be aware of what could happen, educate yourself, but don't lose faith in it, because there are still a lot of quote unquote freedom fighters, if you will, like a lot of people who are out there, you know, boots on the ground doing amazing things to, you know, bring justice where it needs to be served.
Yeah. And Frances, if you're hearing this, we love you, girl. We think you're amazing. And
yeah,
all reports are that she just made the best of it. She went to college. She thrived. She did everything she could. She didn't get to graduate high school, you know, like all because her cousin or nephew, you know, I don't know, man. It just... And then you've got these people who are like, yes, there is gasoline on these pants. And when they told her that in the interrogation, they didn't even have it tested yet.
I don't... Oh, man. I just don't... It's hard for me to understand. It's hard for me to understand people. But it also makes me stop and look inward and think to myself, like, do I do these things? You know, what is my mindset? What is my attitude? Do I bring bias when I'm hearing of stories, when I'm thinking of people? You know, I said this to a class the other day when we were talking about like the Holocaust and things like that, where I was like, guys, you know, the reason why we are always telling you to be kind is we want it to be something that is embedded in you. Like when you look at somebody, you try not to think of them in a bad light. I was like, that's why we're always like, you need to be kind. This is your fellow classmate. This is your neighbor. This is your, you know, like we're on the same team, you know, because you start getting these little seeds of misconceptions or whatever it is. And that stuff grows. And I'm just like, I just want to stay in check and make sure that my negativity or my bias doesn't grow.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And so once again, you know, we apologize for not having Dr. K's interview coming out when we wanted it to come out, when it was supposed to come out.
Yeah.
But on the bright side, you guys got an extra case out of it, an extra episode.
Yeah.
And hopefully, fingers crossed, if we can recover everything, we will try to have that interview published some point next week. So keep your eyes peeled.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think that's wild. A bittersweet ending. More sweet.
Ooh,
I think it's
baby,
more sweet
baby.
Than bitter.
It's a wild world.
It's a wild world. I know.
Well, you guys,
the more
pay
you
attention
know,
to
guys,
the forensic evidence.
The more
challenge.
Yeah.
Challenge.
Question All it, right. man. Question everything.
We love y'all. Thanks for listening. If you have time, make us a review, subscribe. Follow us on Instagram. We love interacting with y'all.
Yeah, we really do. All the things. And remember, we have stickers. They're
stickers.
Hot. I'd love to mail them out to you.
That's right. And we will talk to you guys a little bit later.
All right. Catch you on the flip side. Later,
bye, guys.
Gators. Hey, Wildside Tribe, don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast.
Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
We would love to hear from you. So if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below.
As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.